Hey folks, thank you for becoming a member of Cafe Insider. In addition to the new Cafe Insider podcast, we're sharing bonus material from my interviews on Stay Tuned with Preet. This is exclusively for you. Hope you enjoy it. Is there some role of the press, though, to increase trust in the press? Can you lay it really at the Republicans' feet?
What I lay at the Republicans' feet is not standing up for the institution and the thought of a free press, the concept of a free press. No question, all of us on my side of the world could do a better job, and we work at it, and we try to correct our mistakes, and we reappraise ourselves. That's all important. But we have to own that there are times we haven't done as well as we should by the American public.
You refer to yourself as a raving moderate. What the hell does that mean?
I have a capacity for seeing the wisdom or the good faith, at least, in other people's point of view. And I hear people out. And a lot of times I think that the people who are on the extremes are simply wrong. And I keep hoping that there's someplace in the middle where one can stand and say, you know, that guy's got a good idea and that person arguing with him has a pretty good idea and let's try to find the common ground.
But what's the future for raving moderates?
Very, very bad. we're roadkill.
So
we're roadkill.
I mean, do you think that's worse now than it's been before? The place for moderates?
I think that's right. Yeah, yeah. And I think it's unfortunate that it's seen as somehow a sellout, because I don't think it is. I think it's actually the road forward.
Can I ask you a question? You're a professional and you're a lawyer, but do you ever get pissed off on behalf of your paper?
Very rarely.
Were you pissed off then? Like when people started attacking?
No.
You don't feel this sort of visceral, prideful loyalty when the sacrosanct New York Times is attacked without merit?
I don't, no.
Do others?
I'm sure that there are people who get their buttons pushed. I'm not one of them.
There are other things still that people don't appreciate. I do a little bit because my office sometimes got involved in these things. It's not just sort of figuring out whether something should be published or not, if there's a libel vulnerability or not. But sometimes bad things happen to reporters.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes reporters are kidnapped. And they're in other countries where it's not so safe as it is in a lot of places in the United States. And then a lawyer's services like yours are needed also. Tell us about one of those instances.
Yeah, so I became involved in that dark end of the business in 2008 when our reporter David Rode and two of his Afghan colleagues were kidnapped. They were set up by a Taliban commander in Afghanistan who invited them out for an interview, but then took them hostage, and David was held for the next 7 months. It was not something I was ever trained to do. It was not something I ever expected to do. It was the result of having once written a crisis management plan, which nobody seemed to pay attention to or read or know where it was. But when David was kidnapped, I think people turned to us and thought, turned to me and thought, you wrote the plan. You must know what to do about these things. It was a real learning curve for 7 months.
And how was David Rode eventually brought home?
Well, in June of 2009, so he was kidnapped in October 2008, and so in early June of 2009, when it looked really hopeless, I'd been working with his wife and his brother every day for that entire period, trying to find some way to get him free. Kristen, his wife, called me and said, David just called my mother, he's escaped, and he needs help. Which was a very confusing message for me. I didn't really believe a guy who'd been kidnapped would call his mother-in-law as the first thing out of the box, among other things. But the idea that he had escaped and he needed help was chilling. And we started calling around to our consultants and to the government, and it was clear that Kristen and I and her mother were the only people who knew this had happened. And it became my role at that moment to try to figure out how to go and get him, because he had gone to a garrison, theoretically, nominally controlled by the Pakistani military, but they were in the middle of North Pakistan where their authority was somewhat limited, and it was not clear that if the Haqqani family, the Taliban, came, that they would not turn David and his Afghan colleague who'd escaped with him back to them. So we started rattling the cages of everybody we knew in the government.
So I have to ask this question. Did the New York Times pay any ransom to anyone for the release of David Rode?
They did not pay any ransom. And I know that story circulates, and I know no basis for it whatsoever. I actually had two FBI agents sit with me at one point and go through our books and records and
to find the line item?
To find the line item.
For the ransom payment?
Well, they had a theory as to what had happened, and I was able to disprove their theory by showing garden variety business records we had. So I firmly believe that it happened just the way David said. It is a world where people traffic in rumors, and unfortunately, I think some of those rumors take on the guise of facts too often.
Would the New York Times ever pay a ransom in that circumstance? I understand why governments say that they won't, and they don't.
Yep.
In the United States, at least, you don't negotiate with terrorists. Not every country agrees with that. But what about for a private entity like the New York Times?
It would not be my decision, and I don't know when push came to shove, what people sitting around a table would decide to do. I do know that for families, it's a wrenching decision because they really believe that they should pay and get their loved one back. For an institution like the New York Times, we have to take the long view. We have to understand what does that mean for other reporters elsewhere. And that is a very cold-hearted calculation, but it's the one we have to talk about.
I want to ask you about some things in the current news and maybe about the future a little bit. So Julian Assange has had an indictment against him unsealed. And some people have suggested, well, that's worrisome because in some ways he was a journalist and he was in receipt of classified information. The allegation, obviously, is that he did something to cause the information to come to him, which made him more than just a passive recipient. Floyd Abrams, the estimable Floyd Abrams, who represents your paper a lot, at least initially, as I noted on the show, was not overly troubled by it because of the narrow rendering of the indictment. I wonder what your view is.
And I think it's important that we capture what he's actually charged with, which was he was attempting to do it. He proved to be a fairly poor hacker from what I can gather from the indictment, if the indictment is to be believed. If all we were talking about was someone's attempt to create a fake password in which to breach a secure database, we don't need to talk about whether Julian is a journalist, not a journalist, a publisher, or not a publisher. That is behavior that will be prosecuted. There's no First Amendment exemption to it, and that's simply the way it is. And 20 years ago, a reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer hacked into the voicemail of the Chiquita Banana Company and got a great story and ended up being prosecuted because it didn't matter it was a great story. What mattered was it had committed a crime. So what concerns me about the indictment at one level, though, is that it talks a whole lot about things that reporters do in the normal course, promise confidentiality, talk on encryption communication channels, ask questions. And while it doesn't criminalize them, it puts them in the indictment in a way that makes me concerned that this administration is treating routine news gathering as something other than First Amendment protected activity.
Although maybe some of that information, as you say, is not part of the charge itself, but providing context.
Right.
You're still concerned.
That concerns me, yeah. Yeah, it's an indictment that could have been done without that. And it does concern me that in what was a bungled attempt to use a deceptive password, to use a fake password, that the government felt it needed to spend apparently 8 or 9 years pursuing this. Private Manning has already been prosecuted by a military court. It just seems like a strange use of government resources to me.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago a case where you had an odious client, which goes to the principle that we all learned in law school and continue, I think, adhere to in certain quarters, you know where this is going, that you don't confuse the lawyer for the client and that even odious people are entitled to representation. In fact, they're constitutionally entitled to representation, maybe not the best representation or the most expensive representation, but representation nonetheless. And there have been throughout American history, you know, various people who have been held in high esteem who have represented people who have been held in the lowest esteem. I don't know if you have a view on this, but it just popped into my head because you mentioned it. You have this case of the Harvard House Dean, undergraduate house, where people live sort of dormitory, but call them houses. And he has essentially been relieved of his duties as dean because he is one of the criminal defense lawyers for Harvey Weinstein. What do you make of that?
I don't really have a point of view on that particular case because there are a lot of facts there, and I don't know him, and I don't know quite what his motivation was. But in a general principle, I don't think I don't think lawyers should be confused with their clients.
Is there any piece of advice that you have gotten that you think is worth remembering and sharing with other people?
Generally?
Yeah. It can be about anything. Your golf game, if you choose?
No, I wish I had a golf game. I worked for a judge at the State Court of Appeals, Richard Simons, and he really emphasized that there are very few things in life that can't be corrected. You work like hell to get it right the first time, but understand that if you get it wrong, that's the time to stand up and fix it and make sure you're getting it right on the do-over. And I found that over and over again, that when we try to hide our mistakes or make our mistakes stand up, we end up in a very bad place.
Thanks again for becoming a member of Cafe Insider. Listen to the Cafe Insider podcast every Monday with me and Ann Milgram, and stay tuned every Thursday.